Advanced Placement, or AP classes, have been around since the 1950s and are now offered in over 22,000 schools across the U.S. It was once reserved for high-income, high-achieving schools, but since the 1980s, a much more diverse population of students are part of the program. That's the topic of the book, Learning in the Fast Lane, The Past, Present, and Future of Advanced Placement, by Dr. Chester Finn Jr. and Andrew E. Scanlon. Last fall, I spoke with Andrew Scanlon about the book and about AP in the U.S. He is a research and policy associate at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute in Washington, D.C. I asked how he got involved in this project.
Well, yeah, so we've been working together over the last 2 to 3 years. And at the beginning of this, my co-author, Checker, as he's better known, he actually took AP back in the 60s. And used his success on AP exams to help as he went to Harvard to get 1 year off his undergraduate degree, essentially. So something that was called an AP year at the time. So he had his own history with AP and the potential that AP could have for his college experience and shortening it up and helping him get some credit in advance. For me, the opportunity to work with Checker over the last couple of years was something I couldn't turn down. He's been working education policy for so long and is seen by many as someone who is really an authority on these topics. But also, you might hear from my accent, I'm not actually from the United States. I didn't grow up with AP. I actually grew up in Ireland. And to me, I was really interested in learning more about this program. That was sort of the closest thing I could see to what we have in Ireland as a sort of content-heavy exams that are administered in Ireland to about 50,000 kids a year. Now that it's a whole different program over in Ireland, but it's the only it's the most comparable thing I saw to what we've got in my own country. Yet the scale is just massive. I mean, you're talking about 50,000 kids taking end of high school exams, content heavy in Ireland, and you got about 3 million kids taking about 5 million exams in AP. So it blew my mind when I learned this, and I wanted to learn more about it. I also wanted to see how it's developed over the years, how the focus of the program has changed, why it's changed, and sort of how the student makeup has changed as well, how the demographics of those who take it has changed, and wanted to see why, how, and in what ways.
So let's get basic. What is AP? How is that defined?
So AP, or Advanced Placement, is a name given to the program that administers about 38 exams in the United States in 2019. The exams are spanning everything from calculus to studio art to French, all sorts of what you might term liberal arts courses. And essentially, it's administered by the nonprofit college board. So it's not run by any state or any other entity. And they provide a framework, a course framework for how to, for teachers, essentially for how to teach each course. And they also, they leave it quite a bit up to the teacher to determine curriculum around that framework. But they also accredit each course that a teacher teaches to make sure that it's a uniform course that's being taught across the country. So what you get in California is the same, say if it's an English language or say if it's English literature, it's the same thing you get in California as you get in New York. And each 3-hour exam is administered in May that high schoolers take. Each exam is scored on a rating of 1 to 5, with 3 being termed a qualifying score by the college board. So that would mean that essentially when you get a 3 in that course, you are showing that you are taking a college level course in high school and proving that you are adept at it. And that's essentially it in a nutshell, is a advanced coursework for high schoolers at a college level.
And not to take away any of the good that this does, but this has become a pretty big profit center for the college board, hasn't it?
It is the biggest. I think it's over a couple of years ago, it has become the biggest source of revenue for the college board, just passing the SAT. So it definitely is a huge source of revenue for the college board. And they recognize that. They would counter that they pump a lot of money back into the program. So, for example, they provide a lot of resources to teachers available throughout the year to help improve their instruction. They provide all manner of workshops for teachers to meet with other teachers and to gain more understanding of the program and how to teach it and instruct it in a better way. While there is a fee to take an AP exam, there are degrees of subsidies for that are made available for states to subsidize the cost of exams for low-income kids. And there are other mechanisms that the College Board uses to try and help with the cost of administering it. But no, it is their biggest source of revenue.
Well, AP has been around for a while, since the 50s. I guess it really came into the public view with the Garfield High School experiment. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so we talk about that in a chapter two of our book. That really gets to the core of one thing that we looked at, which was how has the program changed from something that in the 50s and 60s was really the preserve of a privileged few, really elite public high schools and private high schools were all that were offering AP. It wasn't really available to the public at large. And I think what happened in Garfield High School was that we had a really talented calculus teacher who went into his classroom with the mindset that if we can raise the academic outcomes of this group of kids, which is largely Hispanic group of kids in a particularly low-income part of Los Angeles, and basically change the mindset in that school that these kids were capable for a high-level calculus course. What happened in that story was that the first time the kids took their calculus exam after having this inspirational teacher and inspirational leadership at their school, they passed it. But because this was not something that had been done up to this point, the kids were accused of having cheated on the exam, and they had to take it again, and they passed it again. And I think their success on such a high-level course, I think, helped to begin change that mindset for many people that AP exams, advanced-level coursework, was something that can be given to a much more diverse group of students. And this is something that, after Garfield, we see the College Board also sort of moving towards as well, as the amount of students taking AP across the country from more diverse backgrounds starts to increase at a steady clip. And the amount of students who succeed in AP begins to increase at a steady clip as well.
And Garfield High School's story also got made into a movie, right?
It did, Stand and Deliver. I think, I can't remember the year that it came out, but actually quite a popular movie that came out, Stand and Deliver, yes. I recommend anybody to learn more about that story, check out the film.
You say in the book that AP really hasn't changed much since they began. There are more tests now, more subjects, but in the beginning, it seems to be an enduring way of doing things. Why is that so?
The actual rigor of the exams and the way that the exams are kept rigorous hasn't changed too much over the years. It's even thinking of the way that the exams are scored, it's still kind of an old-fashioned way of doing things that certain AP teachers are brought together each summer and essentially to grade exams together. It's sort of an opportunity for teachers to work with similar-minded professionals and to sort of a professional development opportunity for teachers too. But it's really just essentially people marking exams almost by hand or looking through exams by hand, because these exams aren't just like standardized tests. You're dealing with actual writing here and heavy content. Now, the one ways in which the exams have changed over the years is that it's often been criticized in the past for being sort of a mile wide and an inch deep, the content that's been covered on these exams. But there's been some pushes in recent decades and recent years to focus on less content areas in a given subject, but to allow teachers to go into a bit more depth on them. So we've seen some changes in U.S. history and world history over the last couple of years, which have definitely helped that teachers get to a little bit more depth on certain topics. But other than that, it's really stayed quite rigorous and the same. I mean, the overall exam pass rate has not budged too much over the last number of years. It's definitely reduced a little bit, but it's the process by which they maintain rigor has been quite consistent.
You talk about some locations and how they are dealing with the exams and with the curriculum. Two that you point out, one is in Texas and the other in New York City. Let's talk about Texas first. What are they doing there that is special?
AP is one of these things that how it's administered in different cities and different states can look different, as it's left very much up to schools and districts, you know, on a school level, really, essentially, to determine how many classes are offered there. We looked at Fort Worth, Texas. We looked at an example of when an external partner called the National Math and Science Initiative partnered with the district there, Fort Worth Independent School District, to increase the amount of AP exams made, first of all, available to their student population, which is predominantly low-income and students of color, in a way that they haven't had before, but also to boost the numbers of qualifying scores these kids got. So it was really a three-year project that NIMSI, as they're also called, the National Math and Science Initiative, they partnered with the Fort Worth Independent School District by instituting heavy professional development for teachers, by offering support to schools to provide these courses, by financially supporting them as well. And then they hope to see that each year the amount of kids entering the courses expand. And this happened. These were schools that had pretty much no AP in advance, and often in this district, AP was provided in some of the more elite public high schools. After their involvement, a lot more schools that would never have had it have now getting kids in through those doors. And the numbers of kids did go up a little bit in this district of those who scored a qualifying score above. The issue, I think, is that the more kids who came into the course, the pass rate overall dropped. And this is something that we wrestle with throughout the book, because it's an issue for funders if they're helping a program get off its feet in the district. When they see pass scores go down rapidly, it looks like it's not working. And we recognize that, but at the same time, to see numbers of actual students getting into a class they wouldn't have had access to beforehand and also to succeed in it, that's also important independently of that. But it's tricky. With AP and these initiatives that happen in districts and cities to expand access, you also have to expand access, but also think about how you're going to bring those kids up to expand the rates of success they have too. It's two separate jobs you got to do there.
Yeah, it sounds like they're being offered to some kids who maybe aren't ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these kids are coming from backgrounds where they may have been to a middle school or elementary school that hasn't been doing their job for them. And they're coming into high school and they're a couple grades behind, and to be expected to go in and do a advanced level course, it's difficult. It's a really heavy lift. When it's been successful, and we saw this elsewhere in particular, where it's been most successful is when a high school has really used AP as an engine for driving reform in that school. It's been sort of the central focus of administration at that school for success. When it's sometimes implanted onto a school and the teachers don't have so much buy-in and the principal doesn't have so much buy-in if the district is planning it on their school from high up, it's harder to get that kind of success. You can't just open doors to AP and expect it immediately to prove successful for kids. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. You need to be training teachers. Teachers need to be prepared. The students need to have some buy-in. And all that takes a good school with good leadership to do. In Fort Worth, we saw some variety in this. The schools where we saw evidence of there being strong leadership and strong buy-in, they seemed to, you could see some of the results come through their qualifying scores. And the schools where we talked to that seemed to have a negative opinion about how the district placed AP on their shoulders or on their plate, we didn't see so much success. So a lot has to be in place for AP to be successful, and it really needs to be put as, you know, front and center of a full reform strategy.
Still to come, our conversation with Andrew Scanlon continues with a look at how a school in New York City is using AP to go to work for their students. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Andrew Scanlon, a research and policy associate at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute in Washington, D.C., and co-author of a book on advanced placement classes called Learning in the Fast Lane, The Past, Present, and Future of Advanced Placement. In the book, Andrew and his co-author, Dr. Chester Finn Jr., talked about the Urban Academy, a group that operates over 20 schools in the New York City area. They focus on one school in particular, the Urban Academy School for Law and Justice.
Yes, the School for Law and Justice is in Brooklyn, in New York City, and they had this unique way of looking at AP, is that they knew that they weren't going to, I mean, it's 38 subjects, they knew that they weren't going to do offer 38 subjects to their kids, but they focus on a couple that were really unique for their local population and also sort of what the school was focused on, which is more towards a sort of legislative and legal future for the kids and what they do next. They had a few different subjects that they focused on. They focused on English language, microeconomics, and later environmental science, psychology, U.S. history. They introduced each course sort of in an incremental way, knowing that they had to sort of build up a culture of success in kids being used to taking AP in the first place. These kids had not had any experience with AP before. They had about 460 kids in their student population. They're mostly Latino and students of color from low-income backgrounds, and they put AP front and center of how they were driving success into school. And they wanted to make these kids think of themselves as college level, college material, and sort of change mindset for them from the beginning. So, but they also recognized they had to do it in an incremental way. Even in how they introduce certain courses to these kids the first couple of years, they might position some courses as maybe something for kids to take in 10th grade, like U.S. history, and then dive into something like psychology in 11th. And just getting kids used to the idea of high-level courses in a way that maybe we didn't see so much in Fort Worth, where we saw a lot of subjects transplanted onto schools en masse and a lot of not so much the ground-up sort of gradual incremental change that we saw in the School of Law and Justice. But they saw success. We looked at their data, and it looks like the amount of kids who were getting qualifying scores started increasing each year. They made it known to kids that the doors are open to AB courses should they desire. And we saw also subsequent success in their graduates after school and into college. Again, it's a small example, but it shows that when you have really strong leadership like they do and really put AP front and center as a mechanism for reform, you can yield some benefits.
How is this being done around the country in smaller school districts? Is it really a district by district thing?
I think that what you get in some districts, it really depends for kids where they're at. If you're a kid in a big city or a big coastal state, you're more likely to go to a school that has more AP exams available to you and might be more of a culture of AP in those. If you're in a rural school or in a rural district, you might not have that option. It costs money to have, and it takes time to have teachers in your school who are up to the challenge to teach AP. And in many cases, we see the most AP being taken in big cities and in big coastal states. Thinking of one of the examples of where we looked at in the book, Dublin, Ohio, it's a small district just outside Columbus, and they have about three high schools there. And AP is definitely seen as a huge lever for kids to take advanced level coursework and to look good on their resume, on their transcript when they go into college. But it's not seen as the only way to do that. I think that district also recognizes that things like dual credit, things like IB are also very good options for kids who are trying to show that they are up to the challenge for this sort of advanced level coursework, and that they offer all three options to their kids. And there's also efforts there to offer good career and technical education options, and also to cater for those kids who for AP may just not be the right option, whether it's too advanced or it's not. They're looking at something different to what AP offers. But not every district can do that. A lot of districts are opting just for dual credit other than AP. So dual credit, you know, they're making that decision for financial reasons or also because maybe they have a partnership with a community college in a local rural area that for the kids in their school, it makes more sense to have that connection between the high school and the community college. So it really depends on a lot of things. We even in a big city like Washington, D.C., we can have a school maybe 20 minutes north of where I am right now that offers 25 different AP exams and one just 20 minutes south of me, which offers maybe five or six. There's a whole variety of how AP is offered in different districts.
Well, speaking of college, is it shown that AP helps? Well, you know, if you got two students or, you know, test scores are similar, if one has AP, one doesn't, does that kind of tip the scales in their favor?
So we looked in depth at the research literature on AP, and generally speaking, yes, it can be shown as causation, but there's a heavy amount of literature that goes into detail about the most successful outcomes for kids are when they score a three or above, that it helps in all sorts of post-secondary outcomes, such as college persistence, college degree completion, doing better in, for example, the subjects that they took in AP. So if you take a science AP, you do better in a science course in college too. The research is pretty consistent on this. What's not as well known is scoring a lower grade on an AP exam, such as a 1 or a 2, what are the positive effects of this? There is quite a bit of research that from the College Board in particular that does point to benefits, and is less so from non-College Board researchers. So the more research needs to be done on, say, the effects of a 2 rather than getting a 3. But I think we're pretty confident in what we've seen, that getting a 3 or above does correlate with success in college. However, the other big thing about that is student selection effects. So with kids who opt into AP exams, there's the question of, are these kids who may have already been likely to do well in the first place, just by the very nature that they're opting into such a high-level exam? And a lot of the research on AP does remark on this being a limitation, that it's without randomized experiments to see, for looking for causation in AP, it's tricky to determine exactly whether that is AP causing that or is it some other intrinsic motivation that the kid has. But generally, yes, being successful in AP exam does correlate with later success.
Well, you close out the book with looking ahead, so let's close this out with looking ahead. What's the future for AP? Apparently, it's not going to go anyplace.
It doesn't look like it's going anywhere. I mean, it's had to mold with the times for the last number of decades. We're talking about a 6-decade-old program at this point. It's seen a lot. Some of the biggest progress that we've seen over the last 2 decades is it has been how it's opened its doors to more diverse students. This really wasn't the goal of the program at the beginning in the 60s and the 50s. And over the last 2 decades in particular, the numbers of students from more low-income backgrounds and from more diverse backgrounds are entering the program, and that can only be a good thing. However, there's still gaps between the population of high schoolers and the population of AP course-taking kids that need to be addressed if we're going to see some equity in who takes AP exams. And the biggest outstanding challenge really for College Board, for the College Board and AP right now is making sure that the kids who enter AP classes, and especially the more diverse groups of kids who wouldn't have in the past, are being successful on the exams. And this is something that, you know, the jury's still out on. We still see big gaps in the performance of kids of color and low-income kids compared to those kids who maybe more traditionally and historically have been in AP exams or in AP classrooms. However, we have seen some progress over the last 10 years in particular. There have been, for more diverse kids, that they've been getting qualifying scores at a similar rate to the more traditional AP-taking kids. So there seems to be some progress in that way, that that gaps are being at least maintained, if not being made bigger. But there's still some big gaps in the success of AP kids. This is something that a lot of other scholars talk about as sort of the big excellence gap that's really pervasive throughout U.S. education. And there's limits to what AP can do and what the College Board can do. It's a high school program. I mean, some of the things that they're trying to do this year, introduce pre-AP courses that are looking at reaching down into, say, the middle school years and see what they can do to prep kids to get them ready for the AP experience. It's limited rollout of that this year, but that might develop into something bigger in the future. But it's really not a lot AP can do with kids who are coming from below par middle school and elementary schools. And it's not the panacea to solve all of U.S. education's woes. But it certainly is a tool that, if used effectively with good leadership and buy-in from teachers and even the students themselves, can really work towards some real reform and some real progress on a school level.
Again, the name of Chester Finn Jr. and Andrew Scanlon's book is Learning in the Fast Lane: The Past, Present, and Future of Advanced Placement. It's important for communities to have their stories told after a natural disaster. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What can communal trauma suffered in Puerto Rico teach us about the response to COVID-19? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Risha Ann Chansky, professor of literature at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez, listens to voices to find out.
In my large-scale public humanities project, Mi Maria, Puerto Rico After the Hurricane, I use oral history and other biographical methodologies to amplify the voices of survivors while building a body of text through which to study community responses to climate disaster. Two initial observations seem particularly relevant to the global crisis that we are currently experiencing. First, participants in communal trauma need spaces to voice what they are experiencing, as self-narration helps to resituate disempowered peoples as active agents in their own lives. The need for such a repositioning supersedes traditional demands for carefully crafted life stories, allowing for the urgency of the situation to shape the narratives. Second, an official report tells one kind of a story. It might state that 1,000 multi-use structures sustained partial damage. However, clarifying that the term multi-use can include a house that is also used as a business causes us to understand those figures differently. And if we understand the classification of partially damaged as inclusive of the loss of a wall or a roof, we can then read this story as one in which someone's home, which is also their livelihood, is uninhabitable. In other words, the narrative elements will not change the facts, but they can change the story. What we have learned about the power of storytelling and narrative transactions in times of disaster can inform our way forward through the communal trauma of COVID-19 and how we might maintain interpersonal connectivity while forging a way forward that is defined by an ethics of care and mutual respect.
That was Risha Ann Chansky of the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.